from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It is hard to hold down a job in many parts of this country without a car. Many working poor will do almost anything to have one, get one, including paying very high interest rates on subprime used auto loans that have become big business for some of the country's richest financiers. Is this a service? Is this a scandal? This hour on Point, big profits, big questions in subprime used car loans for the poor. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Have you heard the ads? No credit, no problem. Have you resorted to one of these loans? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here's an ad for a company in Chicago called Car Loan Cowboy, offering auto loans to people with bad credit or no credit, and promises it here it can get them pre-approved for a loan before they even walk onto the car lot.
Hey, all you bad credit car buyers in Chicago. Are you looking for an auto loan for a great car, but your credit is roadkill? Then CarLoanCowboy.com is your best shot.
Yeehaw!
Your best shot. Joining me now from New York are Jessica Silver Greenberg and Michael Corkery. They're reporters with the New York Times, and they've spent the last year reporting on the booming and controversial subprime used car loan business. They've turned out four big, fascinating stories so far. You can get to that series called Driven Into Debt at our website, onpointradio.org. Jessica, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And Michael, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Tom.
Michael, what's the basic story here? What's going on?
So over the past 5 years, basically since the financial crisis, there's been a big boom in lending to people with tarnished credit so that they can buy cars. While much of risky lending was shut down, has kind of cooled after the financial and the mortgage meltdown. This is one area that's been booming. And just like your intro mentioned, one of the reasons that lenders, all kinds of lenders, banks, private equity firms have been willing to take this risk is exactly what you said, which is that people will do pretty much anything to pay their loan payments so that they can keep driving their car because they need their cars to get to work. So it's become a pretty safe bet. And hence the boom in the amount of lending.
Jessica, this is a very interesting meeting of some of the richest and many of the poorest in this country. What's the profile of the kinds of people that you've found who take these loans? And what's the profile of those who are lending at the top?
So there is a marked disparity. And I think that's one of the things that struck Michael and I as we were looking at what comprised these massive investments that are sold to some of the country's biggest mutual funds, pension funds. There's this big gulf between the borrowers who are taking out the loans. So there are people like one of the women that we interviewed is a woman named Dana Payne. And Dana does not have a job. She was once working at the police department as an administrative aide in Brooklyn. She went with her daughter to a used car dealership in Great Neck, New York, and says that she told the dealer, she had no income. She says, and I remember this striking me as being very stark. She said, "I looked him in the eye and said I could not make a single payment. I couldn't afford this." And yet she walks out of that dealership with a loan for more than $30,000 for a BMW. And she has not been able, as she foreshadowed at the day in the dealership, been able to make a single payment. So it's people like that who are living on the financial margins, who are going to great lengths to get a car. That's on one side. And then on the other side, you have, as I said, these very large mutual funds and insurance companies that are purchasing these investments that promise, at a time when interest rates across the country are pretty sluggish and low, better returns. So there is a massive, I think, disparity.
A lot of people are going to hear this and maybe roll their eyes. I mean, on the one hand, yeah, you and others write about Thomas Dundon, a big player in this out of Texas. He's with Santander. What is Santander Commercial? Is that what
Consumer
it's
called? Consumer USA?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. 8-bedroom home there, indoor and outdoor tennis courts, 3 wet bars, swimming pool, on and on. He's made gazillions of bucks off this business. On the other hand, Jessica, what is somebody with no job and no income doing by taking out a loan for a $30,000 BMW?
So I think that you're pointing to the basic concern, which is, you know, there is this alchemy. We've seen it before. We saw it during the mortgage crisis, where there's this disconnect, a seeming disconnect between the people who can qualify for loans. So basically, you know, you have a pulse, and we would think to ourselves on an individual basis, why would anyone make a loan like that to someone who has no means to repay it? But I think – and that's why in this story what we tried to look at was the mechanisms that Wall Street uses to make more and more of these loans. And what we were looking at is whether the process of securitization, so the process of packaging and bundling these loans into massive investments, encourages a kind of distance, a distance between the lender and the borrower, and might contribute to this kind of broad loosening of credit standards where the lenders are not holding these loans on their books. So there is a potentially a weakening, again, as I said, of the underwriting standards, because they're going to take these things and sell them off into the market. And the concern is there is less scrutiny or less care in who these individual loans go to, because there is this broad kind of lulling or a sense of comfort that investors are given that, well, since these things are all bundled together, they're somehow less risky.
Michael, give us a sense of some of the big players in this. Who's piling in here? People have been very, very hungry, as you report, to get in on this kind of lending.
That's right. So, after the financial crisis, you know, it was hard to make a mortgage. Banks, had to really clamp down on their risky lending. So this area of subprime lending on autos, really attracted a new crop of investors, big private equity firms.
You got big names in here. Blackstone in here. Remind us who they are.
The Blackstone Group. They're one of the largest, if not the largest, private equity firm in the world. I mean, they own everything from ocean liners to airline, actual aircraft.
With very fancy big names on the board and beyond in their circle.
Yes, subprime auto and now subprime auto companies. The Blackstone Group, like a lot of private equity firms, though, their backing, their money are often pension funds. You know, teachers, police officers, firefighters, pension funds that invest with the private equity firm that then find companies to invest in, like subprime auto lenders, and so that became a big player. And again, private equity firms that invested in finance companies like Exeter, Santander, which we wrote about, had a lot of private equity backing at one point. These are not regulated like banks. At least the private equity firms aren't. So it's become, you know, as the banks have shrunk from some of this activity, there's a whole sort of shadow industry that has a shadow lending industry that's cropped up, a lot of it with private equity backers. Now, you know, this is not happening, in a vacuum. I mean, one of the things, and Jessica mentioned it a bit, for the past few years, the Federal Reserve has kept interest rates so low, which has, you know, caused on purpose investors to look for higher yielding investments. And this is one of those things, our subprime auto loans. So that has created a lot of demand for it. Now, the Fed wants that. They want investors to take risks, but to get the economy going, to make loans, so people go buy cars so they can get to work. I mean, all of that is to get things going, and it has gotten going again to some degree. But as we've reported, there's a downside to that because these loans that are being produced have such high interest rates. They have, you know, tricky terms. They get people who already have trouble with money to take on a lot of debt, and sometimes they end up in worse trouble than before they got the loan, leading to bankruptcy. And it's a very painful thing when you lose your car you were stuck. A lot of these people we spoke to had used cars already, but they saw these ads, that incredible ad that you had on, stuff like that. Yeah. That they heard those and said, hey, I can get a new car or a newer used car, get this old clunker off my hands because, hey, I don't need good credit. They go in, get these big loans, and now they have no car.
Jessica, we've got a lot of people writing in saying, look, if you don't have the money, don't get the car. Be responsible, borrower. On the other hand, if you step back, and it seems to be kind of built into the premise of your series here, we've got an economy. We've got an awful lot of people. They need a job. They need a car to get to it. They have to do almost whatever it takes to get that. And here, our biggest financial institutions are ready to gouge them, throw them over a barrel to make that extra few points of interest to make that happen, Jessica.
Well, I think if we look at the process of buying a car, I think it's difficult for us, for anyone who does not have tarnished credit, who doesn't have a kind of winnowing of their options for who to go to get a loan, there's a sense that you can shop around. But shopping around and the idea of browsing for a car with good credit terms, it's a luxury of people who have the time. And time, again, is a kind of luxury. So many of the borrowers that we talked to had, say, an hour or an hour and a half in between holding down one or two jobs to go to a used car dealership. And again, there's a kind of isolation. It's as if you're on an island. And some dealers, at least from the accounts of borrowers, encourage this sense of desperation. They say, you know, your credit is so bad that we only have one or two lenders who are going to offer you a loan.
Here, take, and then the terms take, of these. Right, the terms are terrible. We got a break right here. And behind that dealer, some of the biggest financial institutions in the country ready to dive in, get that high interest on the back of that low hourly wage worker, as you say, Jessica, out there just trying to get a car put together. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about financial giants jumping into high-interest used car loans for the poor, asking if this is the next subprime lending scandal. Is this necessary lending, or is this the super wealthy feasting on the troubles of the poor? With Jessica Silver Greenberg and Michael Corkery, New York Times reporters who have been turning out story after story on how all this is unfolding. Echoes of the subprime housing scandal of some years back, but here we are. You've heard it all over. It's all over the place. Here's an ad for Vanderveer Kia in Akron, Ohio. Whatever your finances look like, they've got a car loan for you.
Good credit.
That's great.
Bad credit?
We got you covered.
No credit.
No problem.
Bottom line, at Vanderveer, you're approved guaranteed.
Buy a Sorento or Sedona and lease a second Kia from $20 a month. Or drive a new Optima for just $118 per month. Only at Vanderveer Kia.
Or maybe you've got a car, just need the cash. That's fine, too. You can get a title loan. Here's an ad for TitleMax. High interest loans in return for the title to your car. If you fall behind, you're out of cash and the car that gets you to work.
Need holiday cash? Come to TitleMax now for cold hard cash. $1,000 to $10,000. Your car title is your credit. Ho, ho, ho. Turn your car title into holiday cash at TitleMax and say, I got my title back with TitleMax.
Great. Need the cash? But here's a Virginia lawmaker quoted by Jessica and Michael says, this is nothing but government authorized loan sharking. Brittany in Atlanta, Georgia. Thank you for calling, Brittany. You're on the air. What's your experience?
Hi, Tom. Yes, about 2.5 years ago, I bought a vehicle with a high interest, loan, and for the last 2.5 years, I've been paying $500 a month, and that was because I had it bad credit at the time. I got high interest, but I also traded in a vehicle and created about a $5,000 gap when I did. And so every time I've gone to refinance, I've basically been in a situation where I can't refinance to get those payments down and get the interest rate lower just because I have to have that cash in hand to be able to bring the loan down to the value of the car. And so I'm basically just kind of stuck.
Have you been at risk of having your car repossessed, Brittany? It happens a lot.
Actually, Tom, that I guess is a different situation where I can make the payments. It's just that I can't save any money and I can't put any money in any other places in my life because it's such a high payment and I can't get out of the loan as well.
Brittany, I appreciate your call. Jessica, a lot of people get trapped in here. Describe how that trap works.
So one of the things, and Brittany, you mention it, is the size of the loans on these used cars is sometimes two or three times the resale value of the car. And that's what's called the loan-to-value ratio. And it sounds a little wonky, but what it is, it's basically the amount of debt compared to the resale value. And when you have a situation where your car is fundamentally worth far less than the loan that you have to pay on it, you get into a situation like Brittany's where you are stuck making $500 a month payments on a car that is just constantly decreasing in its value.
Why would they lend you two or three times the value of the car in the first place? I mean, if the business is to make money off the loan, I guess the answer is obvious. But is it just that? The more they lend, the more they make?
Well, part of it is that that's one of the reasons that they charge such high interest rates, because they're getting so much money up front from the interest that when they get to the end of the loan and should they need to repossess the car, even though it's you know, much less than what's left on the loan, they've made up a lot of the return that they need already. Now, you mentioned the parallel to the mortgage bubble. And here's where autos are different, and Brittany's experience exactly illustrates it. Whereas, you know, the cars are worth, you know, less the day they drive off the lot than the day before. It's a depreciating asset,
unlike a house, which you hope might appreciate.
Right. So houses, yeah, sometimes they're money traps, but the hope is you can put some money into it. You pay off your mortgage. Your house is going to be worth more than the day that you bought it. Not true with cars. Hence that feeling of just you're throwing good money after bad.
And people just can't get out of it. Is this used auto lending subprime a threat to the whole economy like the housing subprime lending was, Michael, or not?
No, I mean, I think, well, it does have echoes of the mortgage crisis in the way that the industry is built, and, you know, certainly the securitization aspect of the way these loans get bundled and sold. It's a mere fraction in terms of dollar amounts of the mortgage market. Nonetheless, you know, if just as the economy is getting going again, and, you know, certainly it's an uneven recovery, to say the least, you know, for people at the top versus people at the bottom. But for people that, you know, just for people that are starting to get on track again, if suddenly their cars are getting repossessed, you know, that could put a dent in some of the progress that's been made. And so it's something we're going to have to see. It's not going to be anywhere near the calamity that befell us in 2008, but it could be painful and could be a setback.
I mean, you can look at this as a service. Hey, look, we're getting you a car and you don't have good credit, so of course it's going to cost you more. Or you can look at it as a systematic fleecing of the, what, underclass? Tommy in Cleveland, Ohio. Tommy, you're on the air.
Hi. My comment is I believe it is creating another bubble. And the reason why it's doing that is the banks aren't getting involved only because they are charging anywhere from like 17.99 to 24.99% interest, which is what the public sees and is what you see. The real reason is of the discount they're charging behind the scenes, and I'm on the dealer side of it, that the public and the media doesn't see.
Now, what do you mean, Tommy? What is behind the scenes here that we're missing?
Well, I'll give you an example. Santander, you mentioned a few minutes ago.
Yeah.
Now, Santander is going to originate an auto loan for, you know, Joe Smith that goes into the car dealership. But what Joe Smith doesn't see and what the car dealership doesn't share with Joe Smith is Santander made what's referred to as part of their approval process, request a discount of, say, $3,000 or $4,000. So not only on that $12,000 or $13,000 loan are you paying 29% or 17, 18 to 25% interest, your loan is also marked up $3,000, which you don't realize because that's what the fee is.
And whose pocket does that go into, Tommy? Into the dealers, the used car?
Straight
to Santander.
Santander's pocket if that person pays back the loan. So the dealer, let's say, pays $10,000 for that car. And now, so they might have that car online for $10,990.
Right.
Someone like yourself with perfect credit goes on AutoTrader.com, comes in. Now, Joe Smith you know, he's coming in on that credit ad that you played from Vandeveer.
Yep.
So he didn't go on autotrader.com. He's not worried about the price of a car. He didn't really come in for one specific car. He came in for that ad.
He needs wheels. Yeah.
He needs wheels. So, you know, he shared with the salesman his credit situation. They, you know, ran his credit. They submitted him to Santander and other companies, which is referred to as shotgunning. And they, and whoever they can, whatever bank the dealer can make the most profit with is who they're going to deliver that
car. But that sounds like you take the worst off and you gouge them right away. On the other hand, his credit's bad, Tommy. What should you expect, Joe Smith, here?
Well, it's just the way the system's working now. But what I'm getting at is, now, if you paid $3,000 more, now that's Santander. Now, there's other companies that discount up to 50% of the loan.
And when you say discount, you don't mean give a deal. You mean get a deal for themselves.
Get a deal for themselves. In other words, if you paid $10,000 for your vehicle and you put $1,000 down that covered tax and title, so your loan amount is $10,000, the dealer, the check to the dealer from Santander or these other companies, may only be $5,000.
You can see if you pay
back that loan, in theory, the bank makes 24.9% interest, which let's say is $3,000 to $4,000 on that loan, plus their discount of $3,000 to $5,000 that they charged the dealer, that they didn't advance the dealer when they originated the loan. So in theory, the bank's making a lot more of that interest than you see or I see.
Yeah.
They're making that discount amount of
Tommy, we got it. It's huge. And Jessica and Michael in the New York Times are all over it. Their latest headline this week is Investment Riches Built on Subprime Auto Loans to the Poor. I mean, I think they're all over that. And investors have been very, almost ravenous to get in on these loans. On the other hand, people need the loans to get the car. With us right now from Chicago, Christopher Gillick, Managing Director at Cullinate Advisors, LLC. It's a broker, dealer, investment banking firm, works in specialty finance, including subprime auto finance. Christopher Gillick, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Some people look at this and see a fleecing. I'm looking in our comments coming in online. Others look at this and say, well, you know, if they can't afford it, they shouldn't take the loan. How do you see what's going on here?
Well, I'm an old beat-up finance guy, and I've been around various businesses for a long time. And if you kind of look into the dusty archives of subprime auto finance, you'll discover that this business, of course, has been around forever and generations. Some of these subprime auto finance companies, the ones that are not quite headline material, they're not Santander and not GM Financial, or family businesses or smaller businesses that have been operating, since there's been a used car market.
You know, we're more sensitive to it now, maybe because we went through the housing subprime collapse and because a whole lot more Americans are now in this boat where they're up against it and have to take loans like these.
Well, certainly it is a very difficult environment to have low income. It's always been tough to have low income in any country, particularly this one, that has a consumer-driven economy, and now it's tougher than it has been at times in the past. But if you look at the subprime auto finance industry, when was it really in its worst crisis? It was in the mid to late 90s. In fact, the subprime auto finance business did pretty well through the crisis and recession. They did have a spike in losses right around 2008. Annualized net loss rates got up to about 12%. Right now, or at about the third quarter of 2014, I think it was, annualized loss rates in subprime auto were about 6%, which happens to be right about where it was before the crisis. This is for subprime auto loans.
And strong profits being made here. I mean, good for the business. What about for the country, for the people who are having to resort to these loans, Mr. Gillick?
Well, there's kind of dueling narratives here, right? The one narrative is, well, these are high-priced loans. They're exploitive. The people who are signing up for these things have few alternatives. They may be making bad decisions based on immediate gratification.
Or immediate need. They've got to get to the job.
Right. Immediate need. I mean, a good inexpensive, dependable used car meets the need for transportation, you don't need to trade up into a high-end vehicle at a high rate.
But a lot of these are not high-end vehicles that I'm looking at here in Jessica and Michael's reporting. And there's plenty of fairly just
sure.
modest cars.
Yes, there are. And there's plenty of auto finance companies that are providing basic transportation to people at loan sizes that are, you know, down around $3,000 to $6,000.
Should the government be cracking down on this? We've got fraud charges flying around in some quarters here. We've got others looking at the whole system and saying this is a kind of gouging. Is this necessary in our economy, or should we crack down on it?
Well, there's charlatans in every business, and they need to be caught and brought before the powers that be. And that's true in subprime auto lending. It's true in politics. It's true in every profession. There's charlatans. So I'm all in favor of enforcing the laws on the books and making sure that there is no misrepresentation of terms to people, that there's no fraud, and that needs to be enforced with all the laws that are on the books today. Mm. The flip side, though, is the opposing narrative is, okay, well, you got folks that have had credit problems. They have had credit problems because of events in their lives, maybe. Maybe it's they've lost their jobs. They've had a divorce. They've had a bad health problem that prevented them to work. Their credit score is in the toilet.
Mm-hmm.
They might not necessarily be at the bottom of the economic ladder. They might be your firefighters, your school teachers, the people who are, you know, bread and butter middle class folks in our communities who have hit a rough patch. And they need to get an automobile. They're coming back. They're trying to rehabilitate themselves from a credit standpoint. And these subprime auto loans do, when they're presented in a fair and full disclosure method, they do provide a path back into the mainstream.
Chris Gillick, Colonnade Advisors, we just got a minute before the break here. I want to thank you for coming on with us from Chicago today. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Okay, Michael, a path to rehab here or easy pickings for lenders? And do you see a few charlatans as the problem or a systemic problem?
Well, I think Chris made a good point. I mean, in terms of that this is, you know, subprime lending wasn't just invented the past few years. It's been going on a long time. I think what now that we're in sort of the boom time, that is such a profitable venture, there's an enormous amount of competition that's come in. So, you know, while the more established companies that have been doing this for a long time, are on the up and up, you know, there's a lot of new entrants into this market. That, of course, is creating, you know, sort of a potentially downward spiral where, if the guy across the street's offering this, I can get you a loan for this. And suddenly that's how, you know, in every industry, that's how the standards started getting loosened. So I think that's because it's gotten so hot. I think there's some concern that things are starting to get frothy, and that's where a lot of the problems are occurring.
But all this talk about boom and froth, that's all at the top. That's all where the lending happens. I mean, at the bottom, the people who are taking this, they're not booming, and their household balance sheets, Jessica, are not frothy.
No, that's right. And I think just to return for a second to what Michael was saying, the real concern here is that there is a boom in the securitization market. We actually have seen that.
Yeah, and bundle them up, sell them to the big guys. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the securitizations have grown something like 300%. Just since 2010. And so between 2013 and 2010. So what we're talking about here is if you have to keep that market going, who do you do it on the backs of? So are you making loans to people you know these loans will doom them, and you're doing it anyway because you need to feed this machine?
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about financial giants jumping into high-interest used car auto loans for the poor and asking if this is the next big subprime lending scandal. We've got Jessica Silver Greenberg with us and Michael Corkery with us, two reporters for the New York Times who have put a lot of work into laying this all out before us. Now we can all look at it, see what's going on. The high interest rates being paid by those who don't have a lot, the very substantial profits being made by those who do and bundling these up. Is this a service for the poor? Is this a ripoff of the poor? And are you comfortable with an economy that produces this kind of what? Opportunity? Exploitation? Well, you can't catch a break at the bottom, but you're rolling in it at the top. We've got a lot of response online here. Dana says, my stepdad is a repo man. Lately, he's been completely inundated. And you write about this, Jessica and Michael, just how many repossession has just exploded. And it's easy these days. They've got technology that shuts the car down if you don't make your payment. The repo guy just comes and takes it. But he says that your article makes investors look like they're taking advantage. But why shouldn't they? Dana writes. There's a lot of money in the repo industry, but also a lot of negligence on behalf of loan recipients. And that's sort of the I mean, like another listener here says, where's the personal responsibility in this? But then Pebbles writes to us on Twitter, how is selling a car for three times more than market with a 25% interest rate not predatory lending? Did we learn nothing? What response do you have, Jessica, to all the reporting that you've done? Which is the heavier? People say, hey, come on, poor borrower, get your act together or don't borrow, or this is predatory?
I think there is I think there's two sides to this. I think that what the nature of these loans, some of them are built as if to deceive. So they come with, like we saw in the mortgage crisis, they come with terms that seem designed to be incomprehensible to the low income, potentially financially unsophisticated borrower, mm-hmm. who again is making decisions based on the disclosures that they're being given, but some of those disclosures are woefully lacking. So you have terms that spike. You have, as one caller I think talked about, there is this dealer markup. Now that markup, the difference, you know, the amount of money that is being charged to sometimes defray the cost that the lenders are putting on the dealers, whatever the reason, is not available for the most part to some of these low-income car buyers. So you're making decisions that are largely in a kind of black box. And so these loans can be very predatory. They can turn into debt traps. And so I think when we look at whether or not this is a service, we have to look at what information people are actually getting at those dealerships and whether they can be expected to make an informed credit decision, whether it's about personal responsibility or whether they believe they're taking out a loan that they think they can repay, in many cases because the dealers are assuring them that they'll be fine to do that. And then they drive off the lot only to find that that $500 a month payment is very burdensome and largely impossible for them to do. So I think you can't just say this is an issue of personal responsibility because some of these loans are specifically designed as if to kind of cast doubt on that personal responsibility.
Right. I think that, I mean, one of the questions we asked over and over again of the lenders, which is who say, you know, this is a very safe type of investment. This is a safe type of lending. People always make their car payments.
Safe for those who lend.
Yeah. Sorry, safe for those who lend. Mm-hmm. You know, default rates are low. You know, if you need to repossess the car, you can do it in a matter of days as opposed to a house, which takes mm-hmm. months. So if it's so safe, then we would ask, why are the interest rates so high? If there's so little risk in lending, even to people with damaged credit, why do you have to charge such a high interest rate?
I mean, in some ways, it seems like a perfect cash machine. People need cars to get to work. And, you know, if they're poor, as you say, they don't have a lot of time or really education in borrowing to go around. And even if they did, they don't have the leverage to get a good loan. The instant they don't pay, boom, you can shut that car down remotely and it's back in your pocket. It seems like a great business, Michael, if that's all you care about.
Well, it is a very good business and it's been proven to be a good business. And, you know, I think you're the person who wrote the email, you know, talked about repossessions and that's, you know, repos are kind of a cornerstone of this lending boom. besides the new technology that's out there, I mean, it's pretty easy to repo someone's car, quickly get the collateral to the loan, and then resell it. Now, as we have reported in one of the stories, mm-hmm. and you've mentioned here, that's gotten even easier because of these new devices, wherein lenders are installing GPS tracking devices that do one of two things. They tell the lender where the car is at all times. So we talked to some lenders, a credit union, that can actually go pull up a map and find out exactly where their car, this person's car is that they've lent to, whether it's at their job, whether it's at their house. So if they need to go get it, they can just go out there and be there in 15 minutes. And then if in some cases, if they don't pay on time, they can shut the car off, disable the ignition so that you can't start your car until you pay, which has put a lot of people in the position where they are calling up their lender saying, I need to get my kids to school. I need to get to work. How much do I have to pay you? And they say that'll be $400, and they hand over their credit card, and then lo and behold, their car starts up.
Oh my God!
It is what one lender described as, you know, sort of the most effective debt collection system he'd ever used. But on the flip side, to the people in these cars, I mean, it's total control that these lenders have over an extremely vital part of their lives. And I think that's a new thing that we haven't seen in this type of lending before, this lending to people.
Troy writes to us on Facebook, says, 3 years down the road, a layoff or sickness could befall any peasant and their lord grows in wealth. To your repo, then Christopher writes, I've been a repo man and I found a lot of the cars were lemons. And the borrowers, the owners, could either afford either the payments or the repairs, but not both. He goes on to say, it's interesting, almost all my repos were in auto-dependent places. When I moved to the walkable downtown of Richmond, Virginia, I noticed a lot less stress around the auto. He says, so it's not so simple to say those getting their cars are irresponsible. They may need them to get to work. And here's another. Ari says, securitization of subprime debt of any flavor should be against the law. No ifs, ands, or buts. Jessica, what about the Dodd-Frank and all the, after the subprime housing boom, we thought there was legislation to rein in subprime lending. Was this not part of that?
Well, there was a very successful push by the dealers. The dealer lobby in this country is very powerful, in part because they have, as I think Chris had mentioned, you know, there's this sense of their mom and pop
they're
dealerships.
Everywhere.
They're right. They're the biggest employer in your district. What they have successfully harnessed that reputation to win a pretty significant carve out from Dodd-Frank. So they are not overseen as other auto lenders are, and it depends, of course, by the CFPB, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. They are overseen instead by the Federal Trade Commission. So you have a group of you have a business entity that's integral to the auto lending process. In this ecosystem, they function very much like mortgage brokers, and yet they're not subject to the same kind of oversight. So that is a big kind of gulf in this market, at least from our reporting. A carve-out, yes.
A carve-out from Dodd-Frank. Bring on your lobby, get your carve-out, and off you go. Jessica Silver Greenberg, Michael Corkery with the New York Times. Please stand by. With us right now from Bloomington, Minnesota is William Black, associate professor in economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, former bank regulator, author of The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. William Black, welcome back to On Point. Thanks very much for being with us.
Good to be back. Thank you.
Sit back and look at this whole booming area of lending and borrowing. What do you see and what does it tell us about our economy, the way it's structured, how we're rolling?
Pun intended.
Yeah.
Yes, and I was born in Detroit and grew up in Dearborn, so
okay.
I have motor oil in my blood system, I
yeah.
think. We are reprising many of the absolute worst mistakes that we just made. So when people go, why would, you know, some person that makes $12,000 a year make a bad decision in life? Why did we, as a society, do what you, your guest just talked about, deliberately create a carve-out so that you can continue the insanity after it blew up the housing world in the auto world? And the answer is that it's really valuable to lots of folks to do the absolutely wrong thing. One of the things, at least while I've been able to hear, I haven't heard, is the, in many ways the most important paragraph in the New York Times column, one of the columns about this. And I'll read that briefly. The intense for demand for subprime auto securities may also be fueling a more troubling development, a rise in loans that contain falsified income or employment information. The Justice Department is coordinating an investigation about this. And you just heard the apt comparison that these folks in the auto world are often operating as if they were the loan brokers, in essence. And that, of course, was the most intense area of fraud. So while we still call it the subprime crisis in housing, it was far more the liar's loans crisis. So liar's loans are where the lenders overwhelmingly, not the borrowers, by the way, overwhelmingly it came from the lenders, according to Tom Miller, the Attorney General of Iowa.
And Jessica and Michael do report this. I mean, they've got, a, as I recall, a case where the would-be borrower says, I have no income. And the dealer just writes down 30K, just like the income right there.
That's correct. And so by what people don't get in the housing crisis is that by 2006, half of all the loans that the industry called subprime were also liar's loans.
But that and whole housing problem created a national crisis, you could say a global crisis. Jessica and Michael are not so sure that this is going to create any kind of meltdown, big crisis. Is it more like just a personal crisis for each of these families that get stuck under one of these?
It's in between. It's not big enough to cause the kind of crisis that we saw when between 2003 and 2006, liar's loans grew by over 500% while conventional loans fell sharply. So it was liar's loans that hyperinflated the bubble. But there we're talking about 2 million by 2006, 2 million liar's loans a year with an average price of somewhere between $250,000 and $300,000. Nearly all of that then securitized. Okay, so it's a much bigger amount, and yes, it caused a systemic crisis. This one won't cause a systemic crisis, but I have met twice recently with a senior Office of Comptroller of the Currency person who is very worried that it's going to cause very large losses to particular banks and will cause bank failures as well. And as your authors have correctly emphasized, it's going to cause and is already causing immense misery, not to all of the borrowers, but to a very large section of these borrowers. The other thing you have to keep in mind is you've tended to talk, is this good for the bank or the lender? Or and that's often not the key. Banks are fictions, despite what the Supreme Court says, you know, about corporations. So actual decisions are made by individuals. And during the most recent housing crisis, you had lenders deliberately making loans because bankers were deliberately making loans that were, from the beginning, sure to cause very large losses.
But they would do fine personally. Is that where you're
going? And you had purchasers, the investment banks again, purchasing loans that they absolutely knew were going to produce very large losses. But the individual bankers make out like bandits. They maximize their bonuses and the income. So while in the early years, this leads to accounting reports of large profits, it is often followed by catastrophic losses to everybody in the food chain, except, of course, the individual bankers, and in this case, auto-type people.
So we've got financial risk, maybe some financial system risk, but I just wonder about an economy that you get rid of good-paying jobs, and then you stomp on the people who come in desperate for a car to try to get to work. It just seems somehow out of whack, Professor Black.
No, you used the word earlier, call-in about the fact that many of the repos in his experience were lemons. And that's actually the relevant economic literature. The famous one is the 1970 article that led to a Nobel Prize for George Akerlof in 2001 on a market for lemons. And that's what he said. Look, in that case, the used car dealer makes the most money by finding the people who are least sophisticated and preying on them, and takes advantage of their superior knowledge and the desperation on the other side of people, and that's where you get significant profits.
Jessica, we've got just half a minute here. Is there any move to tamp this down or not at this point, Jessica?
Well, there are ongoing investigations by the Justice Department, and maybe this is wrong to bring up in the last couple of minutes, but one of the things that I think we need to look at along this chain is the role of the rating agencies, which we didn't touch on in this show. They're a critical part of this, right?
So they're saying AAA again, right?
They're giving the top ratings to some of these bonds, and that can... Again, we saw that during the financial crisis.
Oh,
we saw them give very top ratings to things that were made of largely kind of garbage.
So maybe
loans.
Here we go again. Listeners, you can link to all of this. It's a great read, really eye-popping, at onpointradio.org. Jessica Silver Greenberg and Michael Corkery at the New York Times, thanks for your work, and thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And William Black, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
This is On Point.